Hello and welcome to Sarah Dunnicky, whose debut novel, The Companion, is publishing this summer. When she's not writing fiction, Sarah writes and verifies questions and answers for a variety of TV quiz shows, including Mastermind, University Challenge and Pointless. In 2014, she won a Northern Writers Award from New Writing North after submitting part of The Companion. Sarah lives with a family in Yorkshire, which happens to be where The Companion is set. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
Can you tell us a bit about The Companion?
Yes. 1930s Yorkshire. And Billy Shaw, the son of a mill worker, has grown up in a palace, Potter's Pleasure Palace. Once a cotton mill, but now an entertainment venue. It's got dancing, tea rooms, a roller skating rink, rowing on the mill pond. And it's Billy's world. It's his kingdom. He thinks that he's going to grow up there and end up being Mr. Potter's assistant and running the place himself one day. But just before his 12th birthday, he finds out he's going to be sent up onto the moortops to a house called High Hob to be companion to young boy Jasper Harper, who lives up there. He lives with his mum, Edie, and his uncle Charles. They're both authors. And they're very preoccupied with their own writing, and Jasper's left to run pretty wild. So when Billy is sent up, he finds it a completely different world to the one he's used to down at the palace. Him and Jasper are very much left to run around by themselves. They spend a lot of time hunting the beast, who Jasper is convinced is marauding the local moors. They become pretty inseparable over the next 4 years, have various adventures together. Billy discovers the darker side of Jasper and also gets homesick about the palace. They both go down and visit sometimes. But 4 years after he arrives there, the two writers, Edie and Charles, are found dead. It's recorded as a mutual suicide, and Billy has left the valley. In 2017, Anna Salas is the new appointed custodian at Academe Mill, formerly the palace. As she starts to make her way through the chaotic archives, she discovers evidence that suggests that there's something more to the story of Edie and Charles, and she becomes convinced that the recorded story is not the true story. She begins to gather evidence and begins to question what actually happened on that night when they both died, and also what role did Billy Shaw play?
It's a great book and a brilliant story. Can you tell us a bit more about where the inspiration for it came from?
Well, there were two main points. I live in West Yorkshire, near Hebden Bridge, and there is a place called Hardcastle Crags, which is a beautiful wooded valley. It's a National Trust property, and at the heart of it is an old cotton mill, which in the early 1900s became an entertainment emporium, very much like the palace in my novel. When I found out about the history of the place, I was convinced I needed to set a novel in a similar environment. I love the countryside around there, both the valley and the moortops above. There's often a sense that you get there that of time standing still, you could be back in the 1900s, first when it was a cotton mill, or even later when it became an entertainment venue. And I really felt that I wanted to set my novel there. So I had that in mind when I was trawling through some old newspapers online, and I came across an advert in a 1938 edition of The Times, and it simply said, child companion wanted, age 6 to 7, for boy 7. And the address was up on Bodmin Moor. And I began to think, who is this lonely boy who lives upon the moor who needs a companion? And even more interesting, who is the boy who might be sent up to be that companion? How would he fit into the household? How would their friendship develop? And it was those two things, the inspiration of the mill that I know and love in Hardcastle Crags, and the advert for a child companion.
How much research did you have to do to be able to write a story set during the 1930s, and how did you do that research?
When I started writing, I didn't do a lot of in-depth research because I was already very familiar with the story of the local area. There's a lot of available local history. I think, like a lot of places, Hebden Bridge and its surrounding areas are very proud of their past, particularly the industrial heritage, which has made the place what it is today. So I've lived there for 20 years and I know a lot already about what the place used to be like. There's a lot of photographs available locally, some wonderful collections. So I'm used to seeing the way people dressed and how the buildings looked back then. I was also very fortunate to be involved in a oral history project at the Hardcastle Crags, talking to people. I did that in 2000. So there were people then who remembered the place in the 1930s and 40s, and it was fascinating. Some of them had gone to a school that was in the woods. Some of them remembered the roller skating rink and the roar of the skates as people went round, the songs that they used to sing. And all that information, I was already quite steeped in it. I've got quite a strong connection with the place, and certainly in terms of knowing the place well, walking through, visiting the mill, and being able to sit there and look at the mill. I found it very easy to just get started. I didn't concentrate on the nitty-gritty until I'd written the first draft. And once I got the first draft, I went back and thought, right, so how does a 1920s turbine work? What kind of model car would Charles drive? That kind of nitty-gritty details about where Jasper and Billy would be educated, what kind of education the law said they had to have, all that kind of thing. And occasionally I had to change the story slightly to fit. So I spent a lot of time doing that. A lot of local history books, a lot of local history research available again with the photograph collections, a lot of stuff online. Again, I went back to my old newspapers. I just love all the online databases of newspapers and get lost in them for hours. I even read 1930s reports, coroner's reports of suspicious deaths to make sure I got the tone right. So I did a lot of research like that afterwards, and then I went back and on my edits added that kind of detail.
Sarah, the book is absolutely steeped in atmosphere. There's a beast lurking in the wilds, mysterious figures appearing at windows, and a writer walking out on the moors in her nightgown trying to catch something romantic to die of. How important is the landscape in setting the tone for the companion?
Well, the landscape was really where it all began. I've spent hours walking and running in the valleys and woods and on the moors that are depicted in the companion. And it's a really incredible landscape. In one way, it's wild and it's raw, but everywhere there's relics of its industrial past, whether it's the old lime kilns, the quarries, the chimneys of mills. I mean, from my house alone, I can see 5 chimneys from the old mills dotted around the town. There's the pack horse trails and the bridges. So it's a place where the industry is still very visible, even though now the main industry is actually tourism, and that attracts a lot of people because it is a very beautiful place. It's really stunning. So the landscape was really where it all began, and I feel as though the novel itself reflects that sort of the wild atmosphere, but also the industry, the mill at the heart of it. And there's a timelessness about the landscape. There are moments when I've been to the mill and sat by the mill pond, and just in that silence, as very much like Anna does in the novel, you could almost imagine hearing some clogs clatter across the cobbles in the yard, or the splash of oars on the mill pond, or just catch a glimpse of people foxtrotting past a window. And then a family will come running past in their fleeces and walking gear, and you'll know you're in the 21st century. But I want, one of the reasons I wrote it as a dual timeline was to get that continuity. The fact that that mill has stood there through all the changes of history, from when it was a cotton mill and full of people working all the hours, to when it became a place of fun and games and playing, right through to the modern era, where now it's a National Trust property and it's run as an off-the-grid cafe and visitor centre. But the mill throughout has been the solid thing at the heart of it. And the rest of the landscape, again, you can be walking up on the moors and you can forget what century you're in. It's so easy to slip through that. And I've always loved the moors. I now live on near the West Yorkshire moors, but I grew up on the edge of the North York moors. And some of my earliest memories of going bilberry picking, paddling in peaty streams and making cushiony beds on the heather. And later I pretended to be Cathy, or maybe it was Kate Bush, spinning around looking for Heathcliff. And now I do quite a lot of fell running and following the narrow sheep trods and stumbling through the bogs. And I love that feeling of being a tiny dot on a vast page of the moor. And instead of feeling vulnerable or threatened, you just feel such a part of that landscape, really at one with it. At one point, Billy, he's feeling particularly happy, and he looks up and there's a skylark singing its heart out above him. And he says, "You and me both, mate, you and me both." And I felt that when I've been up on the moor, when I've been running and a deer, when I've been running through the woods and a deer's jumped past me, or running along by the river and there's a heron racing me, and the heron always wins. But it's that feeling of being at one with it. And I think that's what I wanted to try and create in my novel.
In the book, Billy and Jasper are forced together. They didn't naturally become friends in the schoolyard like you would expect of children. How do you think that they feel about each other? Are they friends? Do they like each other?
Billy and Jasper come from such very different backgrounds, and the first 11 or so years of their lives have been very different. And they're thrown together in a very unusual relationship. They're not exactly equals, and it's not master and servant, but they live very closely together, especially in their chaotic environment of High Hob, where really they're thrown upon each other's company all the time, very dependent on each other, almost like siblings, and certainly not like they would be with their usual school friends. There's aspects of each other's lives that they might feel envious of. Initially, Billy might be envious of Jasper's privilege. He had a lot of privileged life, a lot of opportunities, which he's maybe not always taken. But at the same time, as they get to know each other, Jasper then also sees aspects of Billy's world that he begins to envy, the close family life he had down at the mill. It does become a point of conflict between them. It's not an equal friendship. Billy becomes quite frightened of Jasper at times and learns how to tread very carefully with him, knows the buttons to press or not to press, depending on the occasion. But he's also excited and intrigued by the darker side of Jasper. And Billy can be a bit more reserved and a bit more squeamish, but he does quite like going along with some of Jasper's schemes, and it brings out aspects of his personality that wouldn't necessarily come out. At the same time, he tries to temper Jasper. Whether or not they like each other, their friendship doesn't really depend on like, or whether they like each other or not. They certainly admire aspects of each other, and they become very dependent on each other, and they get such a very close bond through the shared experiences of the 4 years they lived together at High Hob that it becomes a unique and unbreakable bond that shapes their future lives.
Sarah, when I think about this book, I often think a lot about Billy and much less about Anna, but it's as much her story as it is Billy's, really. She's a great character. She's got her own highs and lows, and she's got her own story. I wondered if you could talk a bit about her and what is her motivation for solving the mystery.
Well, Anna's big passion is history. And for her, history is about people and their stories, ordinary people rather than kings and queens and leaders and heroes. And as an archivist and curator, she wants to pull together things that ordinary people have left behind, the documents, the photographs, the artefacts, photographs and artefacts, to try and tell their stories and show their legacy. When she first finds out there's reason to doubt the accepted story of the deaths of Edie and Charles, she becomes intrigued. When her investigations reveal more about what actually happened, she's really keen to set the story straight, to get the truth of the matter. Because the fact that people believe that they committed suicide, as it's termed at the time, by mutual agreement, has coloured how people think about the lives that they lived, and also the works, the novels that Edie and Charles produced. It skewed their histories, and Anna wants to put that straight. But she has the problem that she only has a few pieces of the jigsaw. There are certain documents, there are certain photographs, there's not everything. She realised she needs to be particularly careful because although the people who really knew what happened are no longer there, they have left close family members who might not like her new version of events. Like Billy, Anna has started a new life in a strange environment. She's moved from a flat in the centre of a city to an old cottage in the middle of the woods. And she has to find a new rhythm, a very different working environment and make new friends. I particularly like the friendship that develops between her and her nearest neighbour, the retired farmer Frank, who becomes a catalyst for her investigation into the mystery. She's very determined. She quickly falls in love with the mill and the wooded valley that surrounds it, and she wants to make its story more accessible and more enticing to people. She comes up against bureaucracy, apathy and secrecy. I think readers will really get behind her and root for her to succeed, not only in solving the mystery about what happened to the Harpers, but also in turning Aberdeen Mill into a fitting tribute to the people who've lived and worked in it.
Sarah, you've already talked about how the landscape was a big inspiration for you. Are there any books or pieces of music that have influenced your writing?
I think if I was going to try and list the books that have influenced my writing, it would just probably be everything I've ever read, because I think that's sort of how it works. But going back to the famous five, They Liked Mysteries on the Moor, Anna Green Gables, through all the sci-fi and fantasy I read as a teenager and a student, read just about every genre going. But I've always loved historical fiction. Starting again with Jean Plaidy when I was little. I read all of Jean Plaidy. But my current favourite authors include Sarah Waters, Helen Dunmore, Robert Harris, all of whom have a knack of being able to fully immerse the reader in whatever time period they've set their novel in. And sometimes it's hard to believe they weren't actually there in Victorian London or in ancient Rome or at the Siege of Leningrad. I love everything Kate Atkinson has written, and particularly Life After Life and God in Ruins. Her depiction of London in the Blitz and of being a wartime bomber pilot are just incredible. The Brontes seem to have always been in my life, from early readings of Jane Eyre and Wuthering Heights through all the rest. I love to visit the parsonage at Haworth, and the exhibitions there are a great way of finding other approaches and insights into the work. The poetry of Ted Hughes has for a long time now been a huge influence on me. I think particularly since I moved to the South Pennines and got to know the landscape there, which he's written about so vividly. There's so many of his poems that I read and think, yes, I've been there, I've felt that, I've seen that. And there's a timelessness about it. Again, that timelessness of the landscape that he captures in his poems. One book, The Remains of Elmet, which pairs his poems with black and white photographs of Faye Godwin, is one of my favourites. And I was rereading it around the time I started writing The Companion. The poems are about the moors and valleys and villages that I fictionalised in my novel. And there's one poem that I was just thinking about the other day, when he compares a day out on the hills with an armada of ships. And he talks about the light itself leans taut and everywhere exhilarated water. And then another bit, even the sheep standing windslapped high in rigging look heroic. And I was out on the moors running the other day and I looked up in the wind and the rain and on the skyline were two sheep stood above a dry stone wall and some barbed wire with their heads lifted high in the rigging looking heroic. And I think really only Ted Hughes is the only poet I know who just captures those moments so beautifully. As far as music goes, I nearly always listen to music while I'm writing. I can't listen to talk radio or anything like that, and I don't particularly like to write in silence, although that sometimes happens. When I started writing The Companion, I'd just been given the album Standing at the Sky's Edge by Richard Hawley. So I was listening to it quite a bit. And as I was writing the first draft, I just kept playing the album over and over again. And at first it was just coincidence that was the album I had at the time, but it became more and more apt with what I was writing. It's quite a moody, stormy album. There's love and passion, there's murder. And it just seemed to fit so well that I ended up writing the whole of the first draft, just listening to that album on a loop. And sometimes I write at home, sometimes I write elsewhere, but wherever I was, I put on my headphones and I was there, back in The Companion, back where I needed to be to write. And all I needed was the first few notes of the first song on the album. And I could write and be back there.
Sarah, given the genre of your book, is there a book that's a favourite of yours that might surprise us?
I love a good spy thriller. I'm a big fan of John le Carré. His book, A Perfect Spy, is one of my all-time favourites. It's quite a big book, but I just didn't want it to ever end. Maybe I have a secret desire to be a spy. I know a lot of people do, but reading that, I just really got lost in that book. I also love science fiction, particularly Ian M. Banks. One of his books, Succession, mainly revolves around a lot of highly intelligent spaceships talking to each other. It's beautifully nerdy and I love it. And my go-to comfort books are the novels and short stories of P.G. Wodehouse. They make me smile and laugh out loud, as does Terry Pratchett's Discworld series. So they're also a favourite.
Brilliant. Thank you. Sarah, can you describe your writing space?
Well, I have more than one writing space. I often work at my desk I call it my study. It's a space at home with a desk in it. I've got lots of books around it and my computer, but that's also where I work. So sometimes I need to get away from that. I love writing at the kitchen table. It's got a lot of nice sunlight through the windows. I can see a mill chimney outside the window. Or sometimes I curl up on the sofa and happy to write there. What I do have is a pinboard on which I've stuck images associated with what I'm writing. So with The Companion, pictures of the mill, pictures of people from the 1930s, any images that might be associated, sort of an old school Pinterest. And I can transport that around the house wherever I choose to be writing. A lot of The Companion was also written outside of the house, sometimes in cafes, on trains, on the way to work or meetings. Also by the swimming pool, while my daughter was having a lesson, or sitting in a car park waiting for her to come out of an activity. That's when the headphones and Richard Hawley really helped me get back into the zone. Sometimes I also went on location. So parts of it were written in the woods or by the mill pond. I spent one very cold day sat on a stone shelf inside the mill writing. Just it helped to get the atmosphere and a sense of the place.
What is your favourite way to relax after writing, and how do you get out of the minds of your characters at the end of a busy writing day?
Well, it's mainly running and more running. I find two things happen when I run. If I'm on trails and roads, my mind goes off into its own little dreamland and I can draft story arcs and pages of dialogue, even poetry if the mood takes me. I can't always remember it when I get back home, But I love the creative freedom that happens in my mind when I'm running. There's just something about getting into the rhythm of running that makes my mind work really freely. And it's also a good space to work out tricky plot issues or think through a storyline, decide whether it works or not. But the other type of running I do is fell running up on the moors themselves, and it's a very different experience. I'm usually too busy trying not to trip over or fall into a bog to concentrate on anything else, which is great. A form of mindfulness, I suppose, where you're focused entirely on the moment. There's no room in your head for anything else, and it's a fantastic way to clear your mind. Baths are always good as well, which often follow on from the running. I find it a great way to switch off, to lie in the bath, but also sometimes that's where ideas come, so I try to keep a notebook and pen nearby. Reading gets me out of the minds of my characters and into the minds of others' characters, so I do read a lot, and I love to escape into a book after a day of writing. And if all else fails, there's always my dog. He always listens patiently, never criticises, he's always up for a cuddle, and he likes to accompany me when I go running.
Brilliant. Sarah, I'm going to ask you to imagine that the book was going to be made into a film. Who would be in your dream cast?
Well, I've realised that I've made a serious error in that I haven't created a role for Sean Bean, because that was actually my master plan. It's going to be a while before he's old enough to play Frank, which is a shame, so maybe for the next one. In the meantime, I think Bernard Hill would be a good Frank. Charles Harper, definitely Joseph Fiennes. I can just picture him pacing up and down his study in a green and gold dressing gown. And his sister Edie would be Anna Friel with her hair short and waved. Billy's mum, Mary Shaw, would be Keely Hawes. I love Keely Hawes, so she's got to be in it. And I think David Mitchell, the actor and comedian, could be Nathaniel Potter if he can do the Yorkshire vowels. Sure he could. Anna, I think I'll just go for it and have Jennifer Lawrence, please. Because she's always plays such strong characters. I think of her in Winter's Bone, and she's this such a strong, fierce character who can get anything, achieve anything. So I'd love her to be Anna. As far as the younger members of the cast, Billy and Jasper and Lizzie, I just want to see them played by energetic young teenagers. And for whoever played Billy, to look like my dad did at that age, freckled, serious-eyed, but with a cheeky grin.
Great casting. Really good casting. Yeah, Joseph Fiennes.
You would, it would work.
That would work so well. So well. Sarah, The Companion is your debut novel. Was the process of writing the book what you expected it to be, and what were the challenges?
Well, I've always wanted to write a novel for as long as I can remember, and I suppose I did expect it to happen a bit more quickly. But I think one of the problems was I've got boxes full of unfinished stories, beginnings of novels, including a fantastic dystopian epic set in post-apocalyptic Sheffield and Manchester that I began when I was at university and which I've still never finished. So a few years ago, I did get round to finishing some of my short stories, and I had some success with them in competitions. So I thought, so that's what I've got to do. I've actually got to sit down, finish what I've started. I began to take more seriously the idea of completing a novel. I heard about an online writing challenge, which was to write 1,000 words every day for 100 days, beginning on the 1st of January. And everyone who took part logged their word count each day, and I decided to give it a go. And every day I sat down, wrote 1,000 words, and the next day another 1,000 words, and I just kept going, without looking back over what I'd written or doing my editing. And it was incredibly freeing, because up till that point, I'd been very picky and going back and re-editing the first paragraphs over and over again, which is one reason why I never got finished. So I just wrote that first draft and accepted that it wouldn't be perfect, and had to go back and edit again. But at least I had that to start with. When it was finished, it was way too long. It was very wobbly, lots of plot holes, but I could see where I was going with it. And once I started editing it, I really enjoyed that process of bringing it down and tightening it and making it the novel I wanted it to be. I was very fortunate that my literary agent, Lucy Luck, saw an early version of it and really liked it. She did a fantastic job helping me to edit it even further. I think at that point it was still far too long. And she has been fantastically supportive and always behind me with the novel, and always loving it and wanting me to get it out there and get it published. And I was over the moon when I was offered a publishing contract with Orion, and I've been very lucky with my lovely editor, who again has made the editing process so really very enjoyable. It was wonderful to have her guidance and advice on bringing it to where it is today.
Thank you. Sarah, thank you very much. It was really good to hear more about your wonderful book. The Companion, Sarah's debut novel, is out in hardback, ebook, and audio digital download on the 27th of July and is available to pre-order now. Stay tuned for a first listen to the audiobook.
I grew up in a palace, God's own truth, and the best thing were, it were mine. The crowds, they came and went. But at the end of every day, when they traipsed back to the ordinary lives they'd escaped from, I were the one still there, looking down from the top window, waving them goodbye. So all right, technically it belonged to Mr. Nathaniel. But he didn't live there. He had the big house up the hill. He came and went in his motor car. Never slept at the palace. Never ate a full meal, did a day's work or took a shit there. No more owned it than the day trippers did. It were no fairy tale palace. There weren't no turrets or towers, chandeliers or fancy staircases. But we had the biggest swing boats this side of the Pennines. And you can't swing a lass till she screams off a chandelier. Well, not without a blooming big ladder. The sharabanks that rollicked up in the yard might have been shabby, but they were full to busting with smiley-faced, pockets-bulging trippers, all up for a day of first-class entertainment, guaranteed. Potter's Pleasure Palace. That's what old Mr. Potter had my da paint on the wooden sign nailed to the mill wall. Except it weren't a mill no more. Aberdeen Mill, like dozens of others, closed before the Great War. Cheap cotton fabric were being made all over the world, and there were less of a call for the English stuff. But old Jeremiah Potter saw the way things were going. When he died, instead of a worn-out mill, his son, Mr. Nathaniel, inherited a palace. Folk came from miles, from over the border and as far as Burnley and Leeds. They'd pile out the train in Sowley and pour up the road like slow treacle. I went to watch him one Whit Monday with David, the palace handyman. We stood on the wall at the end of the track looking down the road to town. "Like wood ants swarming up an anthill," David said, and he grabbed hold of my pullover sleeve as they passed, as if to stop me being carried off like ants carry off leaves and crumbs. Some came by bus and walked down from the top road through the woods in their weekend best, the lasses carrying their dancing slippers and the roller skates as they trogged down in their boots and their clogs. The nobs arrived in motor cars, honking their horns through the crowds.